भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
So reading from Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 10 Chapter 47 The Song of the Bee and Text 55 Yavantyahani nandasya
Yavantyahani nandasya
Vrajevatsitsa uddhava
Vrajevatsitsa uddhava
Vrajaukasam shana prayana
Vrajaukasam shana prayana
Asan krishnasya vataya
Asan krishnasya vataya
Yavantyahani nandasya Vrje vatsitsa uddhava Vrjaukasam shana prayani Asan krishnasya vataya Yavantyahani nandasya Vraje vatsitsa uddhavaha Vrajaukasam shana prayani Asan krishnasya vataya
Yavantyahani nandasya
Pours many
Ahani
Days
There is
Nandasya,
Nandasya
of King Nanda,
Nanda
Vraje
in the cowherd village.
Avatsit
dwelled.
Sa
he.
Uddhava
Uddhava
Vraja Okasam
for the
residents
of Vraja.
Ishani Priyani
passing like a moment.
Asan,
they were.
Krishnasya,
about Krishna.
Vataya,
Vataya,
because of the discussions. Translation by the disciples of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. All the days that Uddhava dwelled in Nanda's cowherd village seemed like a single moment to the residents of Vraja, for Uddhava was always discussing Krishna. Text 56 Saridvani giradronir Vikshan kusmitan druman Krishnam samsmaran rame Haridaso vrajaukasam That servant of Lord Hari, seeing the rivers, forests, mountains, valleys, and flowering trees of Vraja, enjoyed inspiring the inhabitants of Vrindavan by reminding them of Lord Krishna. Purport. Srila Sridhar Swami points out that as Uddhava wandered about Vrindavan, he reminded the residents of Vraja of Krishna, by asking them questions about the pastimes the Lord had performed in each of these places, namely the rivers, forests, mountains, and valleys. Thus, Uddhava himself enjoyed great transcendental bliss in their association. Om Gyana Tamanandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmalitam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyebhacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Advaita Garadhara, Sri Vasari Gaura Bhaktivinoda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So we're continuing this chapter entitled The Song of the Bee, where Uddhava has visited Vrindavan with a message for Lord Krishna. because the residents of Vrindavan were suffering in the fire of separation from Krishna. And Krishna felt that they needed some consolation. So he sent Uddhava there to explain to them that actually their act of remembering him, smaranam, was non-different from his presence. He was there, and there, Krishna being the Supreme Lord, thoughts of Krishna are also Krishna. And that is a bona fide way of associating with Krishna, is by remembrance. Just like chanting the holy name is also a bona fide way of associating with that Supreme Person. It's not like an ordinary relationship where if there's bodily separation, one has some fantastical remembrance, which is a mental concoction. It's different from the substance of that person. But Krishna, being everything, thoughts of Krishna, if sincere, that Krishna can appear there. And specifically for the residents of Vrindavan, who were the most sincere, he wanted to let them know that when they were remembering him, he was present. So that is the nature of this confidential section of Bhagavatam, as our great teachers have been explaining to us in past classes. This is very confidential, intimate section of the Bhagavatam. Now, the specific topic that struck me when reading these verses, particularly the second verse, which has a purport, is inspiration. The verse reads, "That servant of Lord Hari, Uddhava, seeing the rivers, forests, mountains, valleys, and flowering trees of Raja, enjoyed inspiring the inhabitants of Vrindavan by reminding them of Lord Krishna." And then Sridhar Swami explains that Uddhava would wander in Vrindavan, and he'd go to different places, and he'd see the residents there, and he'd say, "What has Krishna performed at this place?" And such a question plunged the residents of Vrindavan into ecstatic remembrance. And they became very inspired by that remembrance. And Uddhava was also inspired to see their devotion. So it's mutual inspiration. Now, inspiration is a very important part of life. Everyone wants to feel inspired. From inspiration comes great energy. Who has ever tried to work on a project or at a job that they feel completely uninspired about? The time drags. You know? Some say, you know, time flies when you're having fun. But time drags when you're uninspired, or you're uninspired by the task at hand. And in fact, consistent lack of inspiration in somebody's life leads to depression and despair and lethargy, no energy. Motive ignorance becomes prominent, moroseness, you know, no desire to get out of bed in the morning, madness, you know, when one becomes fairly inert and lethargic, one tends to daydream more, which puts the mind into a state of madness, and the mind becomes completely untamed, and people become victimized by that. That's the nature of lack of inspiration, which leads to depression. People look at life and they say, "What I have to live for? What is there worth doing? I mean, what's the point?" And then they, failing to find a solution, they then plunge into depression. But at the same time, when you have inspiration, you're so energetic. In fact, if you're, I know for myself, you know, when I'm inspired about something, I have boundless energy for that task. In fact, you know, what happens is the body fails before my enthusiasm fails. You know, you work, and then it's like, I better face the reality and get some rest, you know. And then I carry on next day. And there's no limit to that energy that comes from something you're inspired about. One mundane example I remember from my life is when I was, just before I became a devotee, I was working on Lord of the Rings in the special effects department. And initially my boss fired me up. He said, you know, 2,000 people are waiting for your job. You're a young kid. Let's see some good work attitude. You know, building models for Lord of the Rings. And I was fired up because I liked Lord of the Rings when I was growing up as a kid. I read it a couple of times. I like model making and I was very inspired by the opportunity I had. And I would work with great energy and great determination. 10 hours a day. I had a lot of energy for that. But then, as I started to become associated with the devotees more, I started to become a little bit Krishna conscious. And then I started to question the reality of this inspiration and go a little bit deeper, you know, what's this all about really? You know, making a movie is making an illusion within the illusion. And plus, it's such a destructive activity, you know. There's a false glamour that is prevalent over this industry, especially like people think, you know, I'm very glamorous because I'm working on the movie job, you know. Millions upon millions of people are going to see my work, what I've done. The expansion of the false ego. And then it's an incredibly wasteful industry as well, you know, because we'd create these big models, landscapes and castles and fortresses and things in miniature scale. And then they'd film it. And so these things would appear on screen for like 5 to 10 seconds max. And so much of this isocyanate foam, you spray it out of two big barrels, big, you know, 40-gallon drums, through a gun which mixes them up through a spiral action with heat, and it comes out and would hit a mold or whatever, and then it would foam up, and then we'd carve that, and we'd, you know, we'd make different molds and stuff. And this stuff is what's called a carcinogen. Carcinogenic means causes cancer. You know, and this, like, we're working on these models of the mist of this heavy carcinogenic vapor floating in the air. You have to wear respirators and everything. And at the end of the day, you know, we'd chip all this foam off these models, you know, because when you're sculpting something, you generally have much more mass to begin with, and then you chip it down to like the form that you want to achieve. And so at the end of the day, you know, we had this big roll of plastic, which is like a tube. We just roll off meters and meters and meters, like 5 meter lengths, chop it off with a knife, tie it up at the end, and then we just stand there and just pump all this foam into it, you know, polystyrene and foam, and just pack the whole thing out in this big non-biodegradable sausage. And we'd tie it up and chuck it in the bin, you know, and we'd fill up a bin, you know, a big skip each day, and chuck it out. And that's really started to get to me, you know, that's wasteful. And you know, another time I went down to the filming studio where they got the where they're filming miniatures, and they got the big armatures and cranes and things, and moving the cameras in and out from the models, lighting and everything. And they got a big crew there, and they don't work too hard. But in the day at lunchtime, they have a massive catered lunch. This really blew me away, you know. And they have like this 8 or 10 guys, you know. And they get bain marie trays, like loads of bain marie trays with 3 or 4 types of salad. You got sausages and steaks, and you know, a vegetarian option. And I'd watch these guys, you know, they'd eat too much, but then you know, there'd be like whole trays of steaks that just get chucked out. And this film is like a monster, you know. Once it starts going, they've just got to keep pumping money into it, because unless you unless you produce your final product, there's no return. So once it starts, it's like this big monster. You've just got to keep feeding it. Otherwise, it'll bankrupt you. Anyway, perceiving these realities, becoming a little more conscious of what I was involved in, and also sensing that there was something higher through my association with the devotees and Prabhupada's books, etc., I became uninspired. And then 10 hours would drag. I remember the last couple of weeks where I was there, they were making Fangorn Forest, a miniature. Fangorn Forest is a twisted, gnarled old forest. And the way they made this forest is that they went to this hillside, which is in Wellington. Wellington's a very hilly town, city. Right next to the ocean, on the south of the North Island. Very windy, more windy than Melbourne. It's a very similar weather pattern, actually, very changeable. But Wellington's definitely more windy. And on one particular, sort of remote head of land head, there was particularly windswept, and there was these very stunted, dwarfed bushes, trees, that grew in a very gnarled formation because of the wind, being buffeted by the wind, so they're all sort of gnarled and bent over. So they went and cleared this, this hill of these old little shrubs. We brought them all into their workshop, there's just chemicals everywhere and stuff. And my job was to cut them up into little bits and then nail them together. Because a miniature tree doesn't quite look like a big tree, like a bush. So you have to cut it up and make it, reassemble it in the shape of a larger tree, because it's going to be a miniature. I remember just cutting these trees up, That wasn't very nice to start with. And then, little spiders and stuff would fall out of the roots onto the floor and then get up and start running. And I thought, you're finished, mate. There's nowhere to go here, You go and hide in some, in some foam dust or something somewhere and then die. You just starve to death or get poisoned. I was very uninspired, And it was so hard. I had to struggle, to get through the day. And eventually my boss and I came to a mutual agreement that it's probably time for me to move on. I wasn't too perturbed by that. By that time, it saved a lot of money, and I was living very close to the devotees, so I was ready to embark on the next chapter. So that was an experience that showed me, when you're inspired, you've got so much energy for the activity. When you're not inspired, it's very difficult to keep moving. It's a real struggle. So everyone wants to feel that inspiration. And what inspires people in material life? It's a fallible inspiration. It's an illusory inspiration. Often when you're young, you're inspired by the prospect of accumulating wealth, of being successful, a business, a nice family, perhaps. Making a difference. So many things. You see the future, the prospect of enjoyment, of success. And, at a certain age, the sex impulse becomes very inspiring. Suddenly the genders become demarcated to you. Before that, you don't really discriminate so much, but then everything becomes demarcated. And then the beauty of the opposite sex, or the charm of the opposite sex, begins to charm you. And that's where all these, poets, the epic poems and so forth come from. They're inspired by that impulse. So many pop songs and everything. It's all about this romantic inspiration. Or the artworks, so many artists paint nudes inspired by the beauty. I mean, of course, it's only beautiful to the human being. If you're an animal, you don't find the either gender of the human being or the human species so attractive. So it's a very what's called conditioned inspiration, conditional inspiration. As Sri Prahlad, anyway, inspired by wealth and the dream of success, also people struggle with great energy. But if we study history, we look at the history books, what we see is such and such. He struggled very hard. He achieved. Then he died. And what happened? His son squandered everything. Or such and such king, you know, he built up his empire. And he tried to govern it based on his deep-seated values. You know, he was a Protestant rather than a Catholic or something. So he set down the Protestant law and he oppressed the Catholics. And he was very proud and everybody was, Jai you. But then the other party took over and his reign was finished. You know, you see all the pages and pages in the history books just full of, you know, struggle in the material world to try and achieve something that in the end amounts to very little. And history tends to repeat itself as well, you know. The new body, the new youth is inspired with the fresh prospect in the world. Thinking, I'm going to do something new, something different. But no, history will show us that there's nothing really new under the sun. Of course, you know, in our modern age, in the past 50 or 100 years, technology has created many new gadgets and things that that human society hasn't seen before. So it seems very fresh and progressive, but if we really look at the thing, the basic activities aren't much different. Like Prabhu here was sweeping the yard before, while the kirtan was going on with the broom, and then he picked up the blower, you know, this loud blow. You know, and it blows all this stuff, you know, rather than having to sweep it, it blows it. Advancement of civilization. The activity is still the same. As Simon said, you know, Prabhupada said, sweep the yard. That's an eternal activity, to clean the yard of Krishna's temple. But now we have great technology. We can plug it into the PowerPoint, we can switch it on, make a hell of a racket, and blow everything everywhere. But really, the activity, the fundamental activity, the result is the same. So what are the fundamental activities of human life, of conditioned life in the material world? Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And all the technologies and so forth, the cultural evolutions, they don't really change that fundamental reality. They just change the means for better or for worse. And many times there is what's known as side effects from a new technology or a new way of doing things. It has adverse side effects. And if we really look at things, when all's said and done, if you look at the Vedic culture, it's very intelligent, sustainable, very good for the human character. It was there for thousands of years. In a very sustainable way, you know. But, you know, the modern culture, it's not sustainable, we see that. And many people aren't inspired these days by the prospect of the future. There's a lot of depression going around. In fact, the World Health Organization says that in this next century, mental health issues, they'll be the predominant, prevailing health issues. Because people have a lot of stress and anxiety. There's one film recently produced called The Inconvenient Truth. Very aptly named. Because it's a reality, a truth that's facing human civilization that's very inconvenient. It's very inconvenient to consider because it really shows dark clouds on the horizon for human civilization in the ecological sphere, specifically global warming. humanity, by its industrial activity in the past, it's only 50 or 100 years, a very short period in the expanse of history, has produced so many technologies, mined the resources of the Earth planet so extensively that it's become a geocentric force, you know, a force of nature in itself, and has tipped the balance in the ecosystem. And therefore, scientists are saying, you know, it can't go on like this much longer, 30 years max, before we start seeing some serious problems like massive droughts. Anyway, I don't want to get too much into this right now, but the point is, a lot of people know about this, and it's becoming more and more common knowledge for human civilization. That human civilization now has exited the age of technology and industrial expansion, and is now entering the age of consequences. And a lot of people see that and they become uninspired. They think, well, what about my children? You know, what about the future generation? What about the continuation of human civilization? What's going to happen? And therefore they get depressed and they feel a lack of inspiration. Life becomes very hard. Because we know even if we're physically tired, if we're mentally inspired, we still have strength. But if you can be physically full of beans, but if you're mentally fatigued or uninspired, it's very difficult to work. You need to carry on. So, Krishna consciousness is for the materially exhausted. That means that the promise of enjoying this world, that inspiration, there's some dissolution there, disillusionment there. That one has thought about and considered the nature of this world, and it's a little bit disillusioned that I don't think it's actually going to happen, you know. This aspiration to enjoy the world. And this creates good foundation for striving in spiritual life. You know, a disillusionment with one avenue of opportunity creates inspiration in another. So, as the Buddhist, the first noble truth is that one must meditate on the suffering of life. That in fact there is suffering. One should get that realization solidly installed in one's vision, and then one will feel inspired to aspire for transcendence. So, in the consciousness, still we need inspiration. And we like devotees who inspire us. We like to feel inspired on a daily basis, because that gives us strength to endeavor in the service of Srila Prabhupada with great strength. And that endeavoring fills us up. Now, I was thinking about, you know, what are different things that inspire us in Krishna consciousness? What makes people take up Krishna consciousness? There has to be some inspiration there. What makes people continue? And often there's many elements there that inspire us in Krishna consciousness. And there's also, it can often be an evolution of inspirations. Like you start off inspired by one thing, and then you get inspired by something else. And eventually your original inspiration might not be so inspiring to you anymore. But you have another, and perhaps a deeper inspiration. So many times people are inspired by the values of Krishna consciousness. By that they see that devotees are peaceful people. They have the values of wanting to develop their character, live simply, live sustainably, live a godly life. You know, many people, they look at say the ecological situation, and think we need an alternative way to be. Like, well, there was a woman who was coming to the urban yoga, and she was very inspired by the prospect of farm projects. A lot of people are very inspired by the prospect of farm projects. You know, an eco village, a village that's sustainable. You live off the land. the food takes on so much more quality, nutrients and significance to you, because it's not just chuck some money at the supermarket and they'll give you some little styrofoam tray with a vacuum-packed capsicum stuck into it. You know, vacuum-packed styrofoam tray with a capsicum. No, you've grown it on the land, you've invested heart into it, you've taken care of it, grown it up in the natural elements, harvested it, cooked it with love. So much more nourishing in so many ways, and also subtly, not just physically. You know, the idea of using cows, you know, taking care of cows, getting the milk, ploughing the land with bulls, a sustainable way to be, you know, a godly way to be. That inspires people, a positive alternative. Or vegetarianism, you know, the value that one should be, not give harm to any other living creature. That often in the beginning, somebody identifies very strongly with that value. There's one fellow, Daniel, who's so disturbed by, he's coming to urban yoga, so disturbed by the abuse of animal rights that he wants to do a law degree simply so he can represent animal rights causes. And then Prabhupada, you know, he was saying, you know, a devotee will not hurt any living being, even a small ant. What is this nonsense slaughterhouse? So hellish. And we identify with that value, you know, that value of compassion. Also, what might inspire us is the character of the great souls. Or Ram Kumara, or more important, you know, Prabhupada, the spiritual masters, the great souls, the Vaishnavas, we heard about Narottam Das Thakur yesterday, that one can be such a great saint, so saintly and righteous in character, so devoted. That character, we see that and we become very inspired. We think, I'd like to be like that. What if everyone was like that? How wonderful it would be. It would be the spiritual world. Because everybody is a pure devotee in the spiritual world. Another friend of ours who's coming along to urban yoga, he's reading Srila Prabhupada's Lilamrita. And as is common with that book, you know, you pick it up and 4 days later you put it down, finished. It's not like Bhagavad Gita, you know, where people, you know, struggle through it over a matter of weeks or months. No, the Lilamrita is like magnetic, like a tractor beam, you know, absorbed in it. 4 days later, you finished it. So he's having the same experience, you know, reading about Prabhupada, the man behind, the pure devotee behind the movement, his activities, his character, his pastimes. Very inspired to see a manifestation of the teachings. Somebody actually apply it. Because more than just information, the Krishna conscious knowledge is lifestyle knowledge for application. And when it's applied, one becomes very, very beautiful soul. One becomes a devotee. And that inspires others. Just simply I'm reading Transcendental Adventure at the moment, Cormorant's book, The Great Transcendental Adventure. Prabhupada said, you know, he understood. He said, I just travel to inspire my disciples. And a small gesture from Prabhupada would consolidate a devotee's spiritual life for 30 years. A small comment, a small gesture, or even just seeing Prabhupada with this intense, unwavering conviction. You know, that would, you know, just even a moment's association. Like we heard that nice story from Kadamba Kanana Swami the other day about the artiste in Mayapur with the beret chanting 75 rounds before noon. You know, just like he looks like a kami, you know, but he's chanting 75 rounds going to all the artis. And Kadamba Kanana Swami went up to him and said, are you a demigod? He said, maybe. And then later he emailed Kadamba Kanaswami and she said, I saw that Swami in the park in 1965 or 1967 and I knew I just saw how he's enchanting all his disciples, all his followers, and I knew that man was dangerous. So I stayed away. But it was too late. He'd already, just from a moment's association with Prabhupada, he became inspired. And there's even other stories, like Indrajumna Swami tells a story of him walking around a block in somewhere. And there was this, he was walking around the block chanting his rounds, chanting japa. And he'd walk past a particular house and there's a man standing right at the window watching him. And he walked around and eventually he actually went up and said, Hare Krishna. And what's your story? And he said, well, I chant. I'm just wondering, who you are, because, I chant 16 rounds of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra every day and I follow 4 rules. He said, oh, yeah. He said, have you been to our temple? There's a temple? Didn't know there was a temple, I said, how long have you been doing this? 20 years. He said, really? Fire up. And then he found out his story, He wanted, this Srila Prabhupada was coming to town. And he heard about that, there's some Swami's coming. I'd like to see him. And he went to the lecture, but he arrived late. He arrived just at the end. Prabhupada said, so you follow these 4 rules. No intoxication, no meat eating, no illicit sex, no gambling. And you chant 16 rounds a day. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. And he went, oh no, I missed it. But anyway, he went away and applied that much. And then eventually he moved into the temple. I don't know if he moved in because he had a wife. But a moment's association. Just seeing the force of pure devotee with absolute conviction. Often we're inspired by, especially in the beginning, by the profound knowledge. We read Science of Self-Realization and Prabhupada's going for it. Dogs run around on 4 legs and modern civilization is no different. They're simply running around on 4 wheels, eating, sleeping, mating and defending. You're not this body, you're a spirit soul. This whole knowledge that just hits us. That's true. I know that. Somewhere inside me, I know that. And when I hear it, that just consolidates. And that gives so much inspiration when you hear transcendental knowledge and you just know that this is true. Our friend Dale, he's very inspired. He's reading Prabhupada's books, very inspired. He's saying, this just makes perfect sense to me. Transcendental knowledge, very inspiring. Or maybe we're inspired by the prospect of actually serving some godly cause. Like Silvana, who moved into the temple 6 weeks ago, something like that. 6 or 8 weeks. She was saying the other day that, what I like is that it's not about me. It's not about me. Previously, in material life, we do all these things, we get our car, we organize our job, we get our apartment, we cast vision, we set goals, and it's all, who's it about? Yours truly, so I can advance in my agenda of satisfying my senses and feeling good about myself. It's all about me, but that becomes very tiresome, And, I'm going to be a servant, I'm going to serve some higher cause, something bigger than myself. That becomes very inspiring. Even Rick Warren, he's a Christian leader. He wrote a book, Purpose Driven Life. And this is biggest selling book since the Bible, And it starts off, the first sentence of the book actually is, it's not about you, it's about God. It's about serving God. It's about the glory of God. It's amazing, that book sold millions and millions of copies. So obviously it struck a chord, It's a pretty daring thing to do. That's the first book. It's not about you. A lot of people just be like, okay, forget about it. See you later. I'll just throw that in the bin. No, it inspires people, That prospect of being something bigger more important and more glorious and more righteous than ourselves. Being a servant, you know, Advaita Acharya, one of the greatest servants of Lord Chaitanya, he'd be sitting in a feast with the devotees, with the Vaishnavas, very humbly. And suddenly he'd feel inspired by Bhakti Bhava, by the ecstasies of being a servant of Krishna, of being a servant of Lord Chaitanya. And he'd just leap up. I'm a servant of Lord Chaitanya! I'm a servant of Lord Chaitanya! I'm a servant of Lord Chaitanya! And a servant of his devotees. And then sit down very quietly. Take his prasadam. His ecstatic inspiration, you know, just that feeling, you know, I'm serving. I have such a glorious master. Or many of us get very inspired by preaching. You know, by helping others or assisting others, coming in touch with the nectar that we know is there. You know, sometimes we think, you know, why is there only 40 people in this room, you know? You know, Chris, who was here recently, he's, I think, probably run up north to Moolumba. He was saying to me, you know, this morning program, you know, it's just nectar. I just can't understand why there's so few people here, you know. And we think that sometimes, you know, if only they knew the nectar that's available in Krishna consciousness, then people would be coming in droves. If they knew, you know, following four rules, chanting 16 rounds, although it's a bit of an austerity in the beginning, the door it opens to nectar satisfaction. And this all comes from a lifestyle of discipline, to some degree, discipline, and also a devotional lifestyle. So we think, you know, if only they knew. And that's basically all that preaching is, you know, is to let them know, to give them a taste, to allow them to access that. To remove the barriers, we make it easy. We remove the barriers so they can get that taste, and then that taste itself will pull them in. If they're sincere, they'll get a taste. Their relationship with Krishna will be established, and that will give them strength. Yeah, so we're inspired by preaching, you know, by the prospect of pushing on Prabhupada's vision, because Prabhupada's vision is so big and glorious. Prabhupada knew, and he even said, you know, Krishna consciousness should always be a great challenge, because inspired by the challenge of achieving something so great, almost inconceivably big, great, it's like beyond us, to strive for that, we will go beyond what we thought we could do. And that will inspire us to go further. That will give us strength, and that will make life worth living, actually. You know, so Prabhupada has a big vision. You know, Prabhupada, you know, wasn't thinking small. He'd go to a place and have an interview with the head of police or something and say, yes, the churches are abandoned. You should give them to us. You should fund our program of kirtan and prasadam distribution. You know, you can't solve it. You haven't solved the problem. You know, talking to big politicians, you guys haven't solved the problems of crime and things in human civilization. But we see practically, you know, hippies, drug addicted hippies, are coming to us and becoming purified and then dancing in ecstasy. Therefore, you should give us all facility. He's not humble or meek. Yeah, humble. Yeah, of course he's humble and meek as a devotee, but like a lion in the field, you know, just fully confident and thinking big. Thinking world scale, thinking world domination. And that was inspiring. And devotees actually thought, you know, back in those days, you talk to them, you know, back in those days, we thought very soon the whole world is going to be Krishna conscious. Very inspired. And then force of inspiration, you know. I heard one year, you know, in 1975, you know, 4 million books were distributed around the world. That's like pretty far out, you know, for a religious movement, so to speak. 4 million books in a fledgling movement, just pumping them out. That, and for to achieve that, the devotees have to be very inspired. So the preaching is inspirational, and we taste Krishna's reciprocation, the reciprocation of the spiritual master when we preach. What about kirtan? My friend David, he says that he's realizing chanting is the essence of Krishna consciousness. When we chant, all things come. The experience of Krishna consciousness comes. And where else, in an ecstatic kirtan, when all the devotees leaping and dancing and experience an authentic ecstasy, you don't see that in the material world. Last night some people were having a party across the street and pumping some loud music and running around and being idiots in the backyard. I was in the computer room for a little while and I looked out the window and watched for 5 minutes. I was just thinking, this is completely drug-induced. So the hype is not very deep. From a devotee, the joy comes from a deep, it's a deep existential joy that just comes from being connected, for knowing that I am serving the ultimate Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that the kirtan is this, just such a celebration. We find that very inspiring. And sometimes even if we don't, we should just put our energy into it, because we should know, we should have faith that if we put our energy into kirtan, all things will come. One of my biggest inspirations and one of my closest friends, Sitapati, he said to me one day, because he's very enthusiastic in kirtan, he said to me, I said, "You're pretty enthusiastic." And he said, "I'm not always enthusiastic, but I take chanting and dancing as a regulative principle." That means whether you feel like it or not, you do it. I take it as a regulative principle. And that's ecstatic. That means whether you feel like it or not, you should dance from the beginning to the end of the kirtan with as much energy as you can muster. And then inspiration will come, no doubt. Vishnu Jain was also, the devotee said, "You're so enthusiastic, Vishnu Jain," because Vishnu Jain was a very exemplary devotee in kirtan. And "You're so enthusiastic." He said, "I'm not always enthusiastic, but I fully invest myself. I fully invest myself into the kirtan out of love of Srila Prabhupada, I just do that out of duty." Or prasadam, that inspires us as well. Devamrita Swami, my Gurudev, he says, devotees will be saying, "I have this doubt, I have that doubt." And he says, "What about when you take prasadam? Do you have any doubts then?" Nobody has any doubts when it comes to prasadam. You don't even need to think, to experience prasadam. You don't have to speculate. I remember one kid who was coming along in Wellington preaching. Fortunately, he didn't stay. But he was going through a very hard stage in his life, and he was taking some prasadam, and he just said to me, "This food is different. This food tastes like it has no beep in it." He's stool. "Tastes like it's got no nonsense. You mean in a subtle platform. There's something pure about this food. This is wonderful." But ultimately, eventually, we have to become inspired by the beauty of Krishna as Uddhava is, and as the devotees of Vrindavan are. A lot of these other things, like the action and stuff, that's good. We should take whatever inspires us and utilize it to push us on with strength. But eventually, we need to learn how to take shelter of our sadhana to become inspired. There's a little excerpt from a lecture I'd like to read by Devamrita Swami. That ashram leader in Wellington, he uses this quote a lot because it's very on point when it comes to explaining how things often happen in devotee development and in ISKCON in general. It's this quote, this excerpt kind of starts in the middle of things. He's talking about you know, devotees. We are dividing things into two categories. There is the first phase, which is fine if you're in it. Very good if you're in it. In which you just want to do things for Krishna. It's the action phase. It's good camaraderie, good projects, good action. That's fine. Wonderful. And then there'll come the second phase, in which you know that all the projects, all the actions, all the activities, all the striving, all the marathons, are just so that I realize that everything expands from the holy name. At that point, you don't give up all the striving and say, oh, I'll just chant and take Babaji initiation. No, of course not. You understand that the activities, the strivings, are expressions of the chanting. Everything is expanding from your chanting. So your number one priority becomes how to chant without offense. That becomes your quest, how to chant with attention. And you don't get frustrated when you can't do it all immediately. You know that I am basically involved in a lifetime pursuit of attentive chanting of the holy name. So you first of all seize your situation in hand. How can I organize the physical structures of my life so I can chant attentively? When you see you have to organize your life for chanting Hare Krishna, then you naturally start considering what you should do in life. Then things start to become clear. Because Dev Mita Swami, you know, deals with so many devotees, especially young devotees, and they're coming along and saying, what about my future, my future, my future? And many times they say, yeah, okay, your future. For now, just, you know, get regulated in your sadhana. Push that. He just pushes that point for a few years, you know. And what happens is after a while, the devotees go, oh, yeah, sadhana. You know, it all comes from my sadhana. Oh, yeah. Then they start to think, okay, well, I've got to structure my life so I can have good sadhana, and then all things will come from that, you know. And then they start to think, you know, what is the best ashram for me? You know, what sort of job should I have? You know, should I work 70 hours a week as a corporate executive, or should I maybe set up with a little less money, but an occupation that will allow me to organize my day around my sadhana? So things become clear. But if you put everything else first, I got to do this, I got to do that, and then, oh yeah, by the way, we also chant Hare Krishna, then you remain a very nice neophyte in Krishna consciousness. But you don't make firm advancement. And that's what causes problems in the Krishna conscious society. Because the idea, you know, back in the early days, you know, the devotees practically thought, you know, this is more easy to spread Krishna consciousness than it is to practice it. And that makes us feel good about ourselves, like we're powerful, we're good devotees, you know, because we're just pumping out the books. We don't read them, but we're pumping them out, and heaps of people are coming along. They're not really getting a very deep experience, but it's all hype and action. And then what happens? You know, Prabhupada leaves, and so many problems, fractures, and things fall apart a bit, you know, because the transformation hasn't gone very deep. And that still happens, you know, especially passionate young Westerners, even passionate young Indians come along, you know, and they fired up about the action. But eventually, all that action should purify us to the point where we want to really get our nourishment from our sadhana. I'm a perfect example of somebody inspired by the action over the sadhana. But hopefully, you know, that gradually I'll become more interested in chanting Hare Krishna with attention. And studying with attention. So, those of you devotees who inspire for the mature stage of devotion need to understand this point, that all missionary activities, all services expand from hearing and chanting. Therefore, organize your life for maximum attention in your chanting rounds, and you'll see everything else will take off from that. Lecture on Nectar of Instruction, Text 7, March 2001, by Devamrita Swami Maharaj. So, basically, wind up there. Just to say, you know, we want to be devotees who inspire other devotees. We want to be lifters. There's two types of people in this world. There's people that come and sap the energy of a scene or of a group. You know, get the energy, hoard it, don't give any back, and then just leave, and everybody feels drained. You probably met people like that. You hang out with them, and every time you finish hanging out with them, you just feel like kind of drained, you know? And then there's people, you hang out with them, and by the end of it, you just feel like fired up, you know? You feel perhaps good about yourself, or you just feel fired up about some vision. So we want to be lifters. We want to add something to the association of the devotees. We also take inspiration, but we also should always think, you know, how can I add to the association of devotees? And nothing that destroys inspiration in Krishna consciousness than relational clashes. You know, when you want to be fired up, but you know you're thinking all these, you know, if offences have been caused by you, or you're getting offended or mistreated or unappreciated, you know, the devotees, they begin to think, you know, why should I put much energy into this? You know, these people don't appreciate me, they're offensive demons anyway. And it destroys the enthusiasm. So we should always strive to have nourishing sangha, you know, loving sangha, and that keeps the energy high, the inspiration high, because you think, these devotees are wonderful. I want to serve them and I want to serve with them. I want to serve Krishna with these devotees. And we think, we're part of something wonderful, you know. So the inspiration is high, and therefore the energy is high. So we should take it as our duty to conduct ourselves, to inspire the devotees around us as much as we can, even just by being at the program, that's inspirational, you know. Or whatever we can do. And this will be very nice. Just like Uddhava in Vrindavan, you know, he's wandering around. He's inspired. Wow, this place is just the land of devotion to Krishna. My Lord. How wonderful this is. And he goes to a place and he says, hey! So the cowherd boys or whatever, and say, hey, what has Krishna done in this place? And then they'll go, oh Krishna, what did he do here? Oh, I remember, you know. And they're inspired by the beauty of Krishna, by their meditation on Krishna, by their hearing, chanting and remembering. That's how devotees get inspired. Ultimately, many things that inspire us, but we should also strive to make that out. Because that's infallible, that inspiration. Just one last point, you know. Another point Devamrita Swami makes is that, you know, many devotees who base their lives on Prabhupada's books, they don't have problems, you know, because, you know, you might think, oh, I get inspired by projects and stuff, and you get this idea, you say, I got an idea, and you take it to the temple resident and say, hey, you know, this is an idea, can you give me some money and facility, and this would be a great idea, this really inspires me. He says, that's bloody stupid. He says, that's a stupid idea, we're not giving you money, or we don't have money to give you, or whatever, you know, the project gets shut down, you know, it's relying, but nobody's gonna hassle you for, you know, sitting down and chanting Hare Krishna and becoming inspired by that. There's gonna be no impediment to you studying the books and becoming inspired. There's no impediment to coming to the kirtan and becoming inspired. This is the lasting, infallible inspiration that we can get. You know, it's not even so much. You know, you can just do that individually. And then when we all do that, inspiration becomes an abundance, an abundant resource. So thank you very much for your attention. Any questions or comments on these points? Yes, Manavi. Avadvaita Acharya. That's in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Yeah. I'm not exactly sure, but there's many different, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's many different descriptions of the Vaishnava feasts. And there is one particular, there's many different pastimes that happen at these feasts. And also, that's where you learn how to take prasadam. Through these pastimes, the etiquette of taking prasadam with the Vaishnavas is very nicely described. And yeah, that particular pastime here, that's one that my godbrothers, when I was staying in the ashram, he's particularly fond of that pastime. So I know it's from Chaitanya Charitamrita, I can't give you the exact reference. Yeah. Anything else? Want to read the Bhagavatam ki?
Yeah.